Yeah, I think they're right. I think they're right in the back over there. I'm sorry. All right. Good evening, everyone. Let's begin. I want to begin by thanking the sponsors of tonight's shir. To thank Yocheved Levine for dedicating the shir in honor of the yahrzeit of our father Yehuda Leib Ben Tzvi Hirsch, zichrono levracha, and to thank Mayor Anita Gerstein and Moshe and Davida Trapper for dedicating the shir in memory and commemoration of the yahrzeit of Anita and Davida's mother Gittel Bas David, zichrono levracha. We hope that in the merit of our Talmud Torah, the neshamas will have an aliyah and the families a nechama. Thank you for the sponsorship. So let's begin. So number one, beginning of Parshas Truma. Vayidaber Hashem Moshe Lemar. Kadosh Baruch Hu says to Moshe the following: Daber al bnei Yisrael, speak to the Jewish people. V'yikchu li truma me'es kol ish asher yidvenu libo tikchu es truma si. You shall take from me a truma. Tell the people to bring me gifts. You shall accept gifts from me from every person whose heart so moves him. Torah HaKadosha begins in these parshios. Really, again, this is Truma, Tetzave, Vayakel, Pakudei, the story of the first major Jewish fundraiser. Moshe Rabbeinu puts out the first call for a building campaign. We're going to build a Mishkan. We're going to build a Mishkan. And the Torah then goes on in incredible detail, discussing what it is exactly that Moshe Rabbeinu was collecting. The next pasuk, which I didn't put on your sheet, gold and silver and copper and brass and all types of fabrics and all different kinds of things made up this incredible, really overwhelming collection effort. It's actually fast-forwarding a little bit. So not only was this the first fundraising initiative of Klal Yisrael, but it stood out unlike any other fundraising initiative. How so? That Moshe Rabbeinu, in a few parshios from now, has to tell the people to stop giving. Can you imagine this? It's such an incredible idea. The people were so incredibly generous that Moshe said, we have enough. Please don't give any more. So all kidding aside, what's dramatic about it, if you think about it, is that these were slaves. Slaves have no possessions. This was the first time these people ever owned anything in their lives. And yet, again, they were so overwhelmingly generous that they were willing to keep giving to the point that when Moshe Rabbeinu tells them no more, they're profoundly upset and disappointed. An incredible story. But when we come to these parshios, we are often faced with one simple yet exceptionally troubling question, which is why all of the detail? So just to frame this a little bit better, the parashos of Truma, Tetzaveh, Vayakel, Pekudei all focus on the same topic. The topic of the creation of the Mishkan, the tabernacle. Remember again, the movable temple that served our people for 40 years in the desert and 318 years when we entered into the land of Israel. It deals with the creation of the utensils of the Mishkan. And thirdly, it deals with the creation and fabrication of the Kohanic clothing. And every last detail is included here. And this week's parasha really focuses a lot on the details of creating the Mishkan. The Torah tells us down to the last cubit how tall the space was, how large the space was, what the inner area was, the outer area was. There is nothing left to the imagination. If you wanted to recreate your own Mishkan, you could absolutely do so because the dimensions are explicitly spelled out in the Torah. But it leads us to a simple and fundamental question, which is, why? That's always a safe guess, right? Why? But it's the correct answer. Why all of the details? In other words, remember again, we are never going to have another Mishkan. The Mishkan was a structure that served our people during a very specific point in history. We daven every single day for the restoration of the Beis HaMikdash. We await eagerly, we pine for the rebuilding of our third temple. But we will never again have a Mishkan. So here is the problem. The Torah is an eternal book. And every detail recorded in the Torah does not just simply have historical importance, but has contemporary contemporary relevant importance as well. So when you see details like this in the Torah, when you see the Torah get so mired in details that, to be honest, for many of us, myself included, lose our attention very quickly. Once you get into cubits, I'm out, right? Once you start at the cubits, how tall are this? It's just not, and again, deep down, what's really happening is, I'm saying to myself, this doesn't apply to me. This has nothing to do with my life. But again, I want to point out, there are four parshios. Every single line in the Torah is prime real estate. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu is occupying prime real estate. Four parshios of prime real estate with every last detail of the Mishkan. And so the question is, why? So the simple answer, of course, as we know it, is because obviously, if it's in the Torah, you know, when there are two things that you have to, almost like two truths, you have to take with you on learning Torah. Truth number one is if God forbids it, I actually spoke about this a little bit this morning in my Ma'alot class, if God forbids it, then what does that mean? I'm going to call on Henny otherwise, right? If God forbids it, then what do we know? That means we want it. It's an incredible idea. If God forbids it, it means that deep down, we want it. So this is incredibly important because sometimes we look at some of the prohibitions in the Torah and we say to ourselves, you know what? I'm capable of a lot of stuff. I would never do that. You know, we read, for example, you know, one of the simplest example is sections on forbidden relationships, immorality. So you could say human beings have a natural desire for certain carnal instincts or wants, but then there are certain things that the Torah prohibits that you say to yourself, no normal person wants that, right? No normal person engages in behaviors like that. But yet if HaKadosh Baruch Hu prohibits it, it means that yes, that want, that desire is in me. Now maybe for some of us it's at the surface, and maybe for others it's deeper down, but it's there. If the Torah tells you not to eat something, it's because at the end of the day, you want to eat it. If the Torah tells you not to charge interest, it's because there's a natural desire to charge interest. That's number one. If God forbids it, it means that deep down we want it. Number two is that there is no such thing as a statement, a mitzvah, or a concept that does not have contemporary relevance and importance. There is no such thing as a piece of information in the Torah that only has historical importance and doesn't bring some type of impact for me. If it's here, if it's included, if it's part of the Torah, HaKadosh, our Holy Torah, that means there is a lesson in it for me. Therefore, taking this mindset to these parashios, if God is going out of His divine way to include every last detail of the Mishkan in the Chumash, it means that there are lessons to be learned. And what we're going to try to do over the next couple of weeks are to take what at first glance would appear to be very simple, mundane, and you'll excuse me, boring facts, and to show how in fact they are the very building blocks for successful contemporary living. So let's focus on one example of this tonight. Take a look at number two. So Rashi makes an interesting observation, number two. Rashi says, Tikhu es truma si. So God tells us, you should take my truma, take my gifts from the people. Amru rabu seinu, shalosh trumos amoros kam. So the rabbis explained that, interestingly enough, the Torah is alluding to three different types of collections, three trumos, or three different gifts, which were given by the Jewish people. Now, where do we get three? The word truma is mentioned three times. So we see again that, in fact, there were three different collections that occurred. What were the three collections for? Achas trumas sha'asa mehem ha'adonim. One was the collection to create the silver sockets. What were the silver sockets for? So the walls of the Mishkan were made of wood. In order to stabilize them, remember again, you also need things that are portable. So you can't create, let's say, a wall with a wide base like you would naturally, because it'd be harder to transport. So what did they do? They had planks the planks came down to like a point. So if you could imagine, again, the plank is rectangular. Towards the bottom of the plank, it comes in, comes out, and almost, what do you call it? Mounts. Maybe that's the, you know, like an interlocking piece. That piece, that protrusion, would fit into a socket. That socket secured the planks in place. Those sockets... Sorry. Those sockets were ultimately, again, made of silver. So one collection, ultimately, again, was for the silver of the sockets. Next, he goes on. Achas, second line of number two. Achas, chumas hamizbeach. Lukupos liknos men karbanos sibor. The second collection was to go ahead and purchase communal offerings. In the Mishkan and the Beis Hamikdash, there are two different types of offerings. There are individual offerings. I inadvertently commit an avera. I inadvertently violate Shabbos, eat something not kosher. So I bring a karban. I bring an offering for that. But then there are communal offerings. So if I have to bring my own offering, I pay for that. Who brings communal offerings, or I should say, how are communal offerings paid for? They're paid for through communal funds. So the second collection was that the temple should have funds to be able to purchase communal offerings. Va'achos trumas hamishkan nidavas kol echad ve'echad. And the last collection was what they call a general collection. That collection was to go ahead and essentially build the Mishkan. That was the building fund, right? That was building the actual structure, fabrication of the utensils, so on and so forth. So therefore, Rashi tells us, even though the Torah makes it sound like one collection, it's really three different collections. Collection number one was for the silver sockets, so that the wall planks could fit in. Collection number two, animals for communal offerings. Collection number three, general building fund to build the Mishkan. It's riveting, no? Yeah, I could tell, right? Okay, very nice. It's an interesting fact, I guess. But watch this. The Lubavitch Rebbe Zecher Tzadik Livracha sees something fascinating. And what he does is, he at first glance sees a numeric symmetry. Three collections. Where else do we see the number three? So the truth is, we have a lot of threes in Judaism, right? We have Torah Nevi'im Uksuvim, Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov. There are number three, but the Rebbe sees something amazing. Take a look at number three. Take a look at number three. So there's a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. Beginning of Pirkei Avos, Shimon HaTzadik Haya Mishiyari Knesset HaGedola. Shimon HaTzadik was one of the last members of the men of the Great Assembly. Hu Haya Omer, and he used to say, Al Shlosha Dvarim HaOlam Omid. The world stands on three things. What are the three things the world stands on? Al HaTorah, Al HaAvoda, Va'al Gemilos HaSadim. Torah stands on three things. On Torah, we'll discuss what Torah means really. Avoda. Now Avoda, remember again, means two things. Avoda in its pure form refers to sacrificial service, but in the absence of the temple refers to prayer. And lastly, Gemilos HaSadim, acts of kindness. These are the three pillars which support the world. So the Rebbe says something amazing. Look at source number four. So this is based on one of the essays of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And he says something beautiful. Four Aleph. Avodas Hashem shel Yehudi tzricha lehisbaseis al shloshas amudei ha'olam umakbilim l'shalosh shumos ha'mishkan Torah, Avoda, u'gemilos chasadim. So the Rebbe wants to suggest that the three collections correspond to the three pillars. The collection for the sockets refers to what? Refers to Torah. Just as the sockets anchor the walls, just as the sockets provide the foundation, so too ultimately, again, Torah provides the foundation for our lives, which we'll discuss in just a little bit. The second collection is more explicit. Remember again, the second collection was for what? Was for what? Was for communal offerings, karbanos. So therefore again, the second collection corresponds to the second pillar of avoda, sacrificial service, and by extension, prayer. The third collection, which was the general collection, the Rebbe understands corresponds to gemilas chasadim. That corresponds ultimately again to acts of kindness, acts of chesed. So let's analyze this a bit. Because the truth is, we're all familiar with this Mishnah, whether because we've learned the Mishnah or we've heard the concept. The world stands on three things. The world is supported by these three pillars: Torah, Avodah, Gemilas Chasadin. What I'd like to try to do for a few minutes is to analyze these three pillars a little bit and then really understand what it is that the Torah is coming to teach us. So take a look at number four. I'm sorry, take a look. We're going to skip for a moment. Take a look at number five. Rav Yisrael Meir Lau, in his commentary on Pirkei Avos, says something amazing. He says Torah is perhaps one of the most misunderstood entities which exists in the universe. How so? 5 Aleph. HaTorah eino ach v'rak mekar l'knias hayeda. He says Torah is not simply a repository of knowledge. Eich liros ba osef chukim hamefarit keitzad linog b'chol mikra. So he says something amazing. He says, the problem we have with Torah often is that when you ask a person, so what is Torah? So what's Torah? What would you say? What's the purpose of Torah? Tells you what you should do and what you shouldn't do. Right? Torah is a book of do's and don'ts. And that is true. Torah absolutely communicates to us a behavioral norm. Torah absolutely communicates to us behavioral standards. Torah absolutely communicates to us what we should do and what we shouldn't do. But posits Rabbi Lau, Torah is something so much more profound. Limud Torah hu erech bifnei atzmo, amud rishon mishloshes ha'amudim aleihem omed ha'olam. Limud Torah noi barosha rishona lerome mesadam. Do you know what happens? Do you know what happens when you learn? You know what happens when you learn Torah, when you engage in Torah, however you learn, whether it's through coming to a shir, whether it's through opening a sefer, whether it's through listening to something, however you learn, learning Torah changes you. Learning Torah fundamentally transforms you. Learning Torah uplifts you. And I want to tell you something else. Even if you don't feel it, the change internally has occurred. Torah fundamentally makes you into a different person. And by the way, this is not just like a concept for men who have an obligation to learn. This is a concept for all Jews, for men, women, and children. Sometimes the greatest disservice we do in the chinuch of our children, it's not that we don't, we do a good job in teaching our children how to keep Shabbos, how to keep kashrus, but you know, sometimes the one point that's missed is how to properly convey Torah. What does Torah mean? Imagine asking, if your child asks you, what is Torah? So sometimes as parents, our natural, or as human beings, as Jews, it's what you should do, what you shouldn't do. No. Torah is the vehicle through which you become a better person. Torah is the vehicle through which you become a spiritual being. You know, I quoted at Masei Shabbos learning this past week, just to give you an idea as to what Torah is. So the Medrash brings down a mashal. It's a mashal about a king who had a daughter. He had one child, a daughter. So a father is naturally protective of his daughter, all the more so when it's his only child. So it's time for the daughter to get married. And, you know, one guy after the next comes to the door, and as a good father of daughters does, no one is good enough for his daughter, right? But one day a nice young man comes along, and it turns out his daughter likes him. So, you know, once your daughter likes the guy, it doesn't, even if you're the king, apparently, it doesn't matter all that much what you think of him or don't think of him. So the king, the wedding's set, they're going to get married. So the day of the chasana, the king pulls his son-in-law over, and he says, my son-in-law, I love you. You're a great guy. But you know, there is nothing more important to me in this world than my daughter. And now you're getting married, and I'm having like some separation anxiety. So the king says, you know, I'm weighing my options. Option number one is I could tell you that you have to live with me. Okay, but even the king knows, bad idea to have the newlyweds live with the wife's parents. Not a good idea. Option number two, I'll come live with you. Okay, bad idea as well. So the king says, the only request I make is that wherever you go, wherever you settle, have a guest room. Just have a place that I know that I could come and visit. What's the nimshal? What's the message? The daughter, the king, is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The daughter is Torah. The groom is Klal Yisrael. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us his daughter. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us his daughter. It is not easy for a father to give away his daughter. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us his daughter. He gave us his most prized possession in this entire world. And all he says to us is love her, take care of her, and make a place for me in your life so that if I want to see you and my daughter, I don't have to feel like a third wheel. That's what Torah is. Torah is not just a series of do's and don'ts. Torah is not just the playbook as to how to avoid Gehenna. I don't want to go to hell, so I'm going to keep Torah. Right? Here's how to avoid going to Gehenna. That's not, Torah does serve that role, but that's not the be-all, end-all of Torah. When you learn, when you observe, when you keep Shabbos, when you keep Kashrus, when you, whatever halachas, when you learn Torah, you are lifting yourself and fundamentally, cathartically transforming yourself as a human being. You are a better person after engaging in the process of Torah than before you did so. That's the power of Torah. But so often we miss this mark. The Chafetz Chaim gives an incredible mashal. Take a look at paragraph Beis. Actually, Gimel. HaChafetz Chaim magdgim zos ba'ofena ba'echan mimashalav. So he gives a mashal, which is quite beautiful. Adam shalamad ve'eno mekayim. So if a person goes ahead and learns, right, but doesn't observe. Now, he doesn't mean observe like, he means if a person learns, but doesn't do anything with that knowledge, to what could it be compared? Listen to this. La'ashir shahayil asakim rabim. He gives another mashal. In this mashal, there was a very rich man who had many holdings, many business dealings. Pam ne'elatz hayal insua luchu. One time he had to go overseas, he had to leave Eretz Yisrael. Ulam pratim shonim me'asakav lo saval divchui ad shuvo. But the problem is, so many things, many business dealings, he could delay dealing with until he got back. But there were some things that had to be dealt with more imminently. Could not wait for his return. Lefichach, heichin rishima mefuratas. So what does the businessman do? He prepares a detailed list of the things that have to get done. Shebarasha mayesh lebatzea midei yom biyomo. And in the list is very clearly, it's articulated, it's spelled out. What has to be accomplished each and every day? Es harishima nasalam harsharso. He gives over the list to his dedicated servant, to his assistant. Vamalo. Avor arishima zuhetiv. Here's what I need you to do. I need you to review this list very carefully. Kedeshate de malasos. In order that you will know what you need to do. Kishecha. So, okay. Simple. Businessman goes overseas. He comes back home. Sets up a time to meet with his assistant. First question he asks to the assistant. Shalos amashares. Ha'imasisa asasher harisi lecha lasos. Tell me, assistant. Did you do what I asked you to do? Paragraph Dalit. Kain on Hamasharis. So the assistant said, yes, I did exactly what you asked me to do. Kol boker karasyes harishima. Every morning you were gone. I started my day, I read the list. Nu shal balabais, umaod. Okay, I'm happy you read the list. What did you do? Right? Anything else? Zeru Heshiva Mesharis. No, that's it. That's all I did. Kol boker karasi shuv v'shuv be'in. Every morning, I read the list over and over, more in depth, truly trying to understand everything you meant. So again, what a powerful mashal. Says the Chafetz Chaim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us a Torah. But why does he give us that Torah? That Torah is to transform us. That Torah is to uplift us. That Torah is to fundamentally change and better who we are. But what happens? Sometimes I'm like the assistant in the mashal. I get the list, I get God's Torah, and God says, here, take it and become better with it. Take it and become greater with it. And what do I say? I read it. Excellent. Well done. Excellent. God, you really... Excellent, hit it out of the park with this one. Fantastic, good job. And God says, okay, what did you do? Yeah, I read it. You told me to read it. I read it. Obviously, just like the businessman meant for the assistant to read and to do, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, I'm giving you a Torah because Torah has the ability to fundamentally unlock your potential. If used correctly, Torah becomes the basis, becomes the foundation to build the rest of yourself upon. And that's why says the Rebbe so beautifully, Torah is alluded to by which collection? Torah is alluded to by the collection for the sockets. What was the job of the silver socket? What was the job of the socket? To anchor the walls. Without the sockets, there's no Mishkan. Without the sockets, you can't build the beautiful edifice. Without the sockets, there's no place for karbanos. Without the sockets, there are no walls, there are no curtains, there is no aron, there is no sanctuary, there is nothing. Without the sockets, you cannot build. Without Torah in your life, you can build an edifice, but it will not be stable. You could construct things, but they will not have a home. Torah is the socket. Torah is the fundamental foundation upon which everything else is built. You've heard that concept before. But what I'm adding into that is that why is Torah the socket? Why is Torah the fundamental underpinning and foundation of our lives? Because Torah is the mechanism through which we access our potential. Because when you delve into the sea of Torah, you become a different person. You find your inner greatness. You find your inner beauty. You find your holiness. You unlock your potential. All of those kochos remain dormant, remain inactive without Torah. So that's lesson number one, says the Rebbe. The first collection for the Adonim, the first collection for the silver sockets, corresponds to the first pillar upon which the world rests. Torah. But not Torah as simply a series of do's and don'ts. Torah as a way of unlocking our potential. You know where you see this? I make reference to this often. I'll tell you where I see it. I see it, you know, sometimes a person is privileged to have children who come home and share Divrei Torah. So what happens? So this is a scene, I think, that plays itself out in many homes, right? It's Shabbos night. You're pretty exhausted, right? The kids come to the table, and the younger they are, like the thicker the binder is, right? And as a parent, you're thinking to yourself, we're amongst friends, you could be honest. I'm so tired, right? You know, and you're trying to figure out, should I tell them to save it for lunch? Right? Should I tell them, but I want to be an encouraging parent, right? Okay, you muster up the strength. And you know what's amazing? The excitement you could see on the face of a child telling a Dvar Torah, it's difficult to find that same excitement on the face of an adult. Because a child understands that what's happening over here is when they're telling over the Dvar Torah, the Medrash from Mora, whoever. And more often than not, a lot of times like they're reading stuff that someone gave them in school, but they're not explained to them. So they're reading stuff that they don't understand, but they're into it somehow, right? They're proud that they're giving a Dvar Torah. It's incredible because their childlike, untainted heart and soul understands that with every single word that is coming out of their mouth, they are unlocking untold reservoirs of potential. That's what the child neshama understands. That sometimes the adult doesn't understand. At some point in time for us, Torah just becomes about do's and don'ts. Of course I have to learn. I don't want to incur a death penalty for inadvertent action. Of course I have to learn. I want to go to Gan Eden, not to Gehenna. That is true. But you know what I want even more? I want to unlock my potential. I want to find my greatness. I want to become the best person that I can become. And how do I accomplish that? By immersion in Torah, by immersion in the sockets, by creating for myself a fundamental foundation of holiness and spirituality upon which I can build the edifice of my life. Collection number one for the sockets corresponds ultimately again to pillar number one of Torah. What was pillar number two? So pillar number two, remember again, collection number two was what? Quick review, collection number two? karbanos, right? Was four communal offerings. Collection number two corresponds to pillar number two. What's pillar number two? Avoda. So avoda, we spoke about before, literally refers to sacrificial service. And in the absence of sacrificial service, ultimately it's what? It's tefillah, it's prayer. It's prayer. Now, it always struck me, by the way, the word avoda literally means what? Work. So isn't it interesting that sacrificial service and prayer are called work? Preparing for Pesach is work. Getting ready for Shabbos is work. Is prayer work? Karbanos work? So I think what HaKadosh Baruch Hu is trying to teach us is something incredibly profound. What's the common denominator between sacrifices and prayer? They both require you to give something of yourself. So when I bring a karban, you see, we don't realize this, but, you know, cows are expensive. Sheep are expensive. When you bring a karban, what are you doing? What are you doing? You're either taking one of the flock that you have worked hard to raise, you're taking money that you have worked hard for, and what are you doing with it? What are you doing with it? You're giving it to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You have to give of yourself. There's an avoda. There's an effort that's involved there to establish a sense of chesed. Remember again, what's the point of a karban? God needs my animal, right? God needs the flesh. God needs the meat. God's hungry. No. What's the shorish? What's at the root ultimately of the word karban? Karov, to come close. What I'm doing is I'm bringing something physical because I'm a physical being. So because I'm a physical being, I relate to things in a physical way. And even though God has no body, no physical form, the way I relate to the intangible, amorphous God is through physical means. So I bring my animal, I offer it up. But in order to come close to God, you have to work. In order to come close to God, you have to give of yourself prayer. We know prayer is incredibly challenging. Now, it's not so challenging if I just spit the words out, right? If I just daven without emotion, if I just daven without feeling, if I just daven without kavana, prayer is not a very difficult process. But to have a true prayer experience, you know, if Shem Shnufal Hirsch points out, the Hebrew word for prayer we use is tefillah. The shoresh of the word tefillah is psil, right? Really comes from Rachel Imenu. Right? Naftule Elokim Niftaltim Achosi. Right? That same notion of connection. What's prayer about? How do you know if you've had a successful prayer? So we know the one metric you never use is what? Did I get what I asked for? Right? That's not a good metric for successful prayer. How do you gauge if you had a successful prayer? Do I feel closer to God? Do I feel a sense of connection? Do I feel closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu after my prayer than I did before my prayer? If I do, check, successful prayer experience. If not, then I might have to try a little bit harder next time. Tefillah ultimately, again, is avoda. Why? Because in order for it to be meaningful, I have to give of my heart and my soul. The same way it takes effort, it's avoda, to take my money, to take my animal and offer that up on the altar, it takes effort, an incredible effort, to give of my heart, to give of my soul to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and to establish that sense of relationship. Says the Rebbe something absolutely amazing. The second collection of the Mishkan, which was the collection for communal offerings, corresponds to the second pillar upon which the world stands, the pillar of Avoda. And what that pillar teaches us is something incredibly amazing. That if you want to find meaning in your Judaism, it requires avoda. It requires effort. You know, sometimes we think that Judaism should be like one big NCSY Shabbaton, right? It should just be like a big kumzitz. And every single time I think about God, I should feel inspired. Maybe I'll hear like an Eitan Katz song playing in the back of my mind, right? The lights will dim. Somebody's going to be strumming a guitar. And everything is... Spirituality is not like... Well, spirituality can be that way. But you have to work for it. Life is not a big kumzitz, and life is not a big Shabbaton. If you want inspiration, If you want inspiration for yourself, if you want inspiration for your home, if you want inspiration for your children, for your family, you have to work at it. It is avoda. It will never, ever show up at your doorstep. It takes incredible work. Work on every single level. There's the positive, there's the negative. If I want to create an inspired home, I have to ask myself a simple question. What influences am I allowing to come through my doorway? And what am I keeping out? That's in the negative. In the positive, how am I actively filling my home with HaKadosh Baruch Hu? How am I actively filling my home with the Torah we just spoke about before? How am I actively filling my home with dynamic spirituality? That stuff doesn't just show up. It doesn't just materialize. It's avoda. You have to work at it. And you have to work at it every single day, day in and day out. That's the second pillar. What's the third pillar? So remember again, the third collection that was done in the Mishkan was what? The general collection for the Mishkan, which was the collection ultimately, again, to build the Mishkan, to fabricate the utensils. So the Lubavitcher posits that that corresponds to what? That corresponds to Gemilos Chasodim. That corresponds ultimately, again, to acts of loving kindness. So it's interesting. Why does that correspond to acts of loving kindness? Because remember, again, the Mishkan was only built, why? Because everyone contributed. The Mishkan, if you think about it, was an incredibly overwhelming, selfless act. The greatest pitfall that each of us encounter, understand that human beings, we, are egocentric and selfish by nature. That's the HaKadosh Baruch Hu created us, right? Again, it's why the young children love to say, mine, 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 mine. Really, nothing belongs to you. You're a little pisher. You don't own anything, right? Mine, mine, mine. We're selfish. We're selfish at our core. We are innately selfish, self-centered, and egocentric. And it takes a lifetime of work to transcend that. It takes a lifetime of work to become a selfless individual. Gemilos chasodim, chesed means that I must recognize that I cannot live only for myself. My life just can't be about me. The extension of that is that your life can't just be about your immediate family either. Life has to be about your community. Life has to be about your people. And the truth is, as light unto the nations, life also has to be about a life of service to greater mankind as well. We are born innately selfish, self-centered, and egocentric. And our job is to transcend that internal predisposition, to overcome that internal proclivity, and to become selfless people who are able to be dedicated to the other. I want to share with you an incredible medrash. I found it after we printed the copies for the sheets. So I'll just share it with you. Listen to this. This is in the Eliyahu Rabbah. And this medrash blew me away. When the Jewish people were in Egypt, niskaptsu v'yashvu, they like called like a meeting. What the medrash is framing over here is as follows. When Klal Yisrael realized that this servitude was not going to be a fleeting dynamic, but they were going to be there for a while, they had like a board meeting. You know, they got together, the heads of the people, to say, what are we going to do in order to weather this storm? What are we going to do in order to survive? And so they sat down and they came up with a variety of things that they accepted upon themselves so as to maintain national identity. What were the things? Listen to this order. Niskabtsu v'yashu, they got together. V'yashayu kula aguda achas, everyone was united. Karsu bris, they established a national covenant. Here are the things that we are going to do in order to maintain our national identity. Sheyasu gemilos chasodim ze im ze. We will perform acts of kindness with one another. V'yishmeru belibam bris Avram Yitzchok v'Yakov. We will keep the covenant, the bris, of Avram Yitzchok and Yaakov. That doesn't refer to bris milah, but rather again that refers to monotheism. Shelo yanichu lashon beis Yaakov. We will not go ahead and change our language. V'yilamdu lashon Mitzrayim. So these are the things that they took upon themselves. And what was shocking to me was, what was number one on the list? Gemilus Chassadim. How do you maintain your national identity even in the midst of overwhelming 210-year barbaric Egyptian servitude? Chesed. Gemilus Chassadim. When you stop just living for yourself and begin to think about the other, that is how you cement your Judaic identity. That is how you nurture and nourish your Judaic identity, even in the midst of the most difficult of times. I'll share with you something amazing. You know, it got me thinking. I got my first Pesach Shaila today. So I said to the person who called me, I said, this is a record. No one has ever called me with a Pesach Shaila. Rosh Chodesh Adar Aleph. Right? It's a leap year. But it got me thinking about Pesach also. And I realized I've shared this idea in different contexts. But you know, in the Haggadah, and it fits very beautifully with this Medrash, in the Haggadah, we begin the section of the Haggadah with Halach Ma'anya. Right? Halach Ma'anya Diachalo Arsana B'Darabidim Yisrael. We lift up the mouth, we say, this is the bread of affliction that our forefathers ate in Egypt. And what do we say? Kol Dichfin Yesei V'Yechol, Kol Ditzrich Yesei V'Yifsach. Whoever is hungry, come and join us. And Rav Soloveitchik asks on this piece, he says, I don't understand. What kind of invitation is this? I'm inviting people, it's beautiful, I'm inviting people to join my Seder. There's only one problem, which is, right? First of all, again, we already started, right? We drank the first cup, right? We're already into the Seder. Number two, who am I talking to? Right? The people who hopefully were actually invited to my Seder, right? The people around my table. So meaning, if you're going to give a real invitation, go out, stand by the door. Whoever needs a place to eat, a place to have carbon Pesach, a place to have the Seder, come and join me. What am I doing over here? And the Rav says something amazing. Rav Soloveitchik explains, you're right. It's not an actual invitation. What is it? It's a declaration of freedom. You see, there is a concept in Halacha, Ashakana Eved Kana Rabo. A slave cannot own anything, because whatever the slave owns automatically belongs to the master. What we celebrate on the night of the Seder is that we are free. So now again, I have possessions. If I have possessions, then what can I do? I could perform the mitzvah of Hachnasas Arachim. I could have guests. I could open up my home. He explains it because you see something amazing. What is the true definition of freedom? The true definition of freedom is the ability to think beyond yourself. A slave is preoccupied with survival. A slave is preoccupied with keeping his head above water. A slave is preoccupied, ultimately again, with not drowning in the turbulent seas of life. I don't have time to think about anyone else. You know, Viktor Frankl writes that it's amazing. He describes a scene after liberation where, again, the Nazis, Yimach Shem V'Zichem, had already left the camps, and there were a bunch of people who were huddled together around the fire they made in the infirmary. And one of the windows was broken. One of the members of the group was going ahead and fixing the window. And Frankl discusses a young man, a whole ragtag group of survivors sitting around this fire, bewildered. The Nazis were gone, but they had no idea what was happening. And then he says something amazing happened that evening, is that we shared our bread with one another. He said, that was the moment I knew we were free. He said, because the law in the lager, the law in the camp, was eat your bread and the bread of your neighbor if you can. The law in the camp was survive at all costs. There's no time and no luxury of thinking about others. But he says, that night, when we're huddled around the fire in the infirmary of Auschwitz, and we shared our bread with one another, then I knew we were free. Then I knew we were free. That's Gemilas Chassadin. Gemilas Chassadin means it's not just about me and what I could do for myself and how I could advance myself. It's about what I could do for you. It's about how I could serve the other. It's about overcoming my innate egocentricity, self-centeredness, and selfishness, and how to become someone who exists to serve the collective, who exists to serve the nation, who exists to do things above and beyond his own personal interests and need. That's Gemilas Chassadin. That's the third collection. So if we bring this all together, and with this we'll conclude, it turns out that what starts out as a relatively, seemingly innocuous and honestly, somewhat boring piece of information from Rashi turns out to contain such dramatic threefold life lesson. The three collections, the three trumos, correspond to the three pillars. And the three pillars are not just pillars, but rather, again, they are fundamental life lessons which steer us in the direction of successful living. Collection number one was the collection for the sakets. Sakets corresponding ultimately to Torah. Use Torah as the foundation to build your life, but not just as do's and don'ts, but as the key to unlocking your potential, as the key to cathartic, comprehensive life change. The beautiful part of having a relationship with the daughter of God is that she can help you become whoever and whatever you want to be. Collection number two, which was the collection ultimately for communal sacrifices, right, corresponds to the second pillar of Avoda. If you want inspirational Judaism, there is going to be a lot of work. Inspiration never comes easy. Inspiration never comes simply. Inspiration never just shows up at your doorstep or nestles at your feet. Inspiration, an inspired Judaic life, requires Avoda. And number three, the third collection, which was the general Am Yisrael collection for the creation and the fabrication of the Mishkan, that corresponds to Gemilos Chasodin. What sustained our ancestors in Egypt was a bond to one another through acts of chesed. What sustains or what creates true freedom is an ability to think beyond yourself. Gemilos Chasodin means we have to condition ourselves to do acts of chesed every single day. And the incredible part about chesed is that there are so many incredibly easy opportunities. You make a phone call to someone who's struggling with whatever they're struggling with. And in today's day and age, you know, not everybody's comfortable making a phone call. So Baruch Hashem, there are many other more impersonal forms of communication. You send a text, a tweet, an Insta. Can you send an Instagram? No, okay. But you understand, they could friend them. You know, there are so... But every single day, if a person builds chesed into their lives, ultimately saying that, I care about you. I care about you. Imagine again, just going through every day, I have to do an act of chesed today. One act of chesed. I have to be a Baal chesed. That's the third pillar. That's the third collection. Because freedom means the ability to think beyond myself. Freedom means that life is not just about me. Greatness comes when I stop thinking only about myself and I begin to devote my kochos, my energies, and my abilities to the betterment of the other. Three collections, three pillars, and we begin to see how HaKadosh Baruch Hu in His infinite wisdom, in what at first glance appears to be simple, mundane, ordinary information, becomes the very keys, the three keys for successful living. Stop over here.